A big hello and welcome to episode 8 of the Sanyu Sisters podcast. I'm Amber.
And I'm Tista.
Well, Tista, tell us what you've been up to this week then.
So this week, I have just been spending it doing a lot of unpacking as we've just moved into our new home. So there's just been boxes and boxes everywhere that seem to be multiplying. hopefully things are going to settle down soon, and just really excited for this year to start and all the work and amazing projects that are due to come in. So busy with that, really.
Yeah, congrats on being a homeowner. Exciting. Well, this week I have been back to clinical work after Christmas, and it was actually really nice, but kind of feels like you've never been away sometimes. One of my Secret Santa Christmas gifts that I received this over the Christmas period was a scrub cap covered in uteri. I'm not sure what the proper word is, but it's been a great talking point with patients. And I've got my shoes for theatre as well, which are plastered in dogs. So usually somebody, it's a bit of small talk with the patients, which is cool. And I've also signed up to an online dance class just to take a bit of time for myself. So yeah, I mean, who knows how that'll pan out, but it's been fun getting my heart rate up, dancing around the living room like an absolute loon. So that's been my week so far.
Amazing. You're going to have to share with me that link for the dance course. That sounds absolutely brilliant. yeah, and especially with lockdown 3.0, we definitely need something to keep us entertained. Last week, I had the privilege of talking to Megan Kumar, and she was sharing lots of wisdom about building engagement. Alice, who joined us in episode 5, was loving Megan's suggestion of grabbing a virtual coffee online in an attempt to try and get to know members of her new team. I think it's a really great idea, and definitely something that I hope we'll be able to do as going forward, working within the Sanyu unit. Mary in South Africa had tuned into episode 7 and was impressed with Megan's tips, including engaging stakeholders from the outset, understanding context, and her finishing phrases of "don't be shy." And I think that's something that seems to have resonated with quite a few people, is this concept of getting yourself out there and being part of this community as best you can.
Yeah. I wonder who is listening that saw our Twitter or Instagram posts about establishing engagement. And if you did, you'll know that it featured a large diamond ring. Now, Tista, you are already married, so unless your husband has been splashing out on a very expensive Christmas gift, people who know us personally probably knew that was not for you. I, however, ended up getting a lot of messages from fans and family who thought that I had some news to share. Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you all, but hopefully you did tune in to Megan's episode, and yeah, just a bit of fun, eh? And we want to give a shout out to Liverpool's Student Neonatal Obstetric and Gynecology Society, or Liverpool SNOGS, as they are otherwise known. And they are hosting a virtual conference on Saturday, the 30th of January. And the Sanyu Sisters have been invited along to speak alongside a whole host of other great speakers. So you can find a post about that on our Instagram at Sanyu Sisters Podcast, or on our Twitter page, Sanyu Sisters.
And if you haven't had a chance yet to listen to our episode with Megan, please do make some time in your week. It's really full of so much great stuff. This week, Amber's been chatting with Dr. Benjamin Black about the collateral damage of COVID within maternal and newborn health. Let's have a listen to what Benjamin has to say.
Well, I am thrilled to have Dr. Benjamin Black with us today for another episode of Sidestepping COVID, Keeping Research on Track. Benjamin will be sharing his thoughts and experiences with us as we discuss the topics within reproductive and maternal health that can often get overshadowed and forgotten about during a pandemic. Benjamin's a London-based obs and gyne consultant, but he's also completed postgraduate studies in epidemiology and statistics. He has a master's degree from the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, and that was looking at the political economy of violence, conflict and development. He's worked with academic, international and local organisations in some very, very challenging environments. and often looking beyond the medical factors, considers the political, economic, and social interactions at play within these complex settings. As a result, he's gone on and provided assistance in a whole host of countries across the world, and he's also worked in response to the West African Ebola epidemic. Benjamin has many peer-reviewed publications and is no stranger to the media, having written articles for several newspapers and magazines. So as I'm sure all the listeners will agree, we are really thrilled to have you with us, Benjamin, and hear some of your thoughts and experiences.
I'm delighted to be with you. Thanks a lot.
So just to kick off then, it would be really great to get a brief overview of the work that you've done so far and maybe some of your previous or current roles during the COVID pandemic or previous Ebola epidemic that you've been involved with.
Sure. So, I mean, as you already said, I work as an obstetrician and gynaecologist in London, and I still work very much on the clinical side of things. And then I also work in humanitarian response, and I've been doing that for the last 6 years or so. Currently, my main role is a specialist advisor to Médecins Sans Frontières, but I also give some separate consultancy advice to other organisations, such as the International Rescue Committee. I suppose my interest in epidemics really kicked off in 2014 when I was already working in Sierra Leone in obstetrics when the Ebola epidemic began. And I continued working in West Africa throughout that outbreak, responding both to the needs of the general population, people being directly affected by Ebola, but also very much looking at the sexual and reproductive health impacts of Ebola and the lack of access to maternal health care and other sexual reproductive health care. And then following the end of the epidemic, looking at how we could re-engage with communities and try to rebuild trust so that they'd be able to better engage with those services going forward. Since the end of that epidemic, I stayed involved with outbreak response, and I've worked in measles epidemics, cholera epidemics, hepatitis C, and later was working with the Ebola outbreak that took place across 2018-2019 in Democratic Republic of Congo and was sort of along the borders with Rwanda, Uganda, South Sudan and Burundi. So it was, you know, really of high concern and like with COVID-19 had been declared a public health emergency of international concern. And during that time, we're a little bit with WHO, building together better guidance for the way to manage Ebola for pregnancy and breastfeeding, and also working with ARC, looking specifically at how we can make sure that during these epidemics, sexual reproductive health doesn't get forgotten, and how to better help pregnant women and populations in general with sexual reproductive health needs access the services that they're going to continue to need as they would normally, but also the services that they may need specifically because of the changes in context as a result of the epidemic. As I think most of us have experienced during COVID-19, I think the awareness of that has become much more present organically as well over the last year.
Wow, certainly done plenty. And from that experience, it would be really great to know what topics within maternal and newborn health or sexual reproductive health and that whole spectrum tend to get neglected from what you've seen.
I suppose my gut feeling would be to say that all of them do. And I think that I think it goes beyond sexual reproductive health. I think that healthcare in general often gets neglected when you have one specific health concern that then people often get this tunnel vision and prioritize it above all other aspects of healthcare. And so, you know, we've seen that with COVID-19, particularly in the early parts of the pandemic, but we see it in other outbreaks as well, that child health, maternal health, reproductive health, prevention of other diseases, continuing management of HIV, of TB, of chronic conditions, they often get sidelined as organisations move towards what's considered to be the big emergency of the time, and felt to be that this is what we need to get on top of right now. But what we often see is that the overall mortality and morbidity is often greater from the indirect health consequences during those epidemics than directly from the disease itself. And this is where we need to often in ourselves, I remember talking with our colleagues, tried to take that step back and try to have that sort of helicopter view and big picture view of all the different balls that are rolling around at the same time, and not all go running to what we think is the single priority.
Yeah, absolutely. It just, when you said about helicopter view, it reminds me, for those listening here, in obstetrics and gynecology, isn't it, you know, even on a shift on the labor ward, you've always got that one person, whether it's the shift leader or the consultant, who has got that view whenever all little things are kicking off, because you do, people get focused, don't they, and your situational awareness goes. But I guess on a big scale, it can be a little bit like that, as you say, where the attention's drawn to one thing and we kind of drop the ball on a lot of other things, but actually they could be causing a lot more of an issue.
Yeah, no, it's exactly like that.
And whose responsibility do you think it is to ensure that that doesn't happen?
So I think there has to be a shared responsibility, really. I don't think that any one organisation or institution can take single responsibility, because we know that these are complex situations, not just epidemics, but any sort of humanitarian or medical emergency that causes a shift in the way that society interacts and causes a political change or economic shifts, cultural changes, where there's going to be fear within the community, you need to take a really multi-pronged approach. And so, you know, one of the big lessons that we, I don't want to say learn from Ebola, because I'm not convinced that we learn these lessons. I think we keep identifying them repeatedly and then say we're going to learn them. But one of the big lessons that we identified, again, with the Ebola epidemic in Democratic Republic of Congo, was that there needs to be a real joint approach from those who are there specifically for the disease outbreak, that they need to be, from the very outset of the outbreak, looking at the indirect consequences and looking at how to better engage with, for example, sexual reproductive health services. But equally, the organisations that may already be working in sexual reproductive health before the epidemic's even begun, so your normal health services, need to be engaged from the very beginning of the outbreak for them to interact with the disease itself and to interact with the organisations that are there to respond to the disease itself. So there has to really be a symbiotic relationship between these two sides. It can't be that they're working in silos and you know, sort of emails flying between each other. There needs to be joint meetings, joint discussion, and a sharing of responsibility. And that also needs to then, you know, broaden out to bringing in the populations that are being affected, mm-hmm. and the wider community, and making sure that engagement is happening across all levels of administration, but also through all levels of society as well.
Yeah, I think that's so true, and it definitely makes sense. Having been on the ground, have we really learned those lessons? You know, is that actually happening, or where do issues tend to arise?
I do think things are getting better. I think that, for example, with COVID-19, I think that the alarm bells for the impacts on sexual reproductive health were rung much earlier than we saw, for example, during Ebola epidemics previously. I think there was a lot of high-level advocacy. There was a lot of publications within the general media to alert the general population, but it's also a way of getting a bit of political traction on concerns of, you know, what is going to happen during this pandemic. And if you look back, you know, as early as end of February, March, or even a little bit before then, you had quite a lot of organisations and individuals making quite high profile statements saying, you know, the way that this is going, we're going to see an increase in intimate partner violence. We're going to see an increase in teenage pregnancies, mm-hmm. and a loss of access to contraception. And you know, we're going to need to start thinking about how we ensure abortion services are still accessible and safe. And I think that the fact that that was being said really early on and thought about really early on, and even the WHO made a statement early on in this pandemic identifying the need for the continuation of sexual reproductive health services. It's the first time that WHO's ever done that during a large-scale epidemic, to make a very clear identified statement that this is important, shows that, you know, there is a recognition that we have been lacking in this previously. It doesn't mean that we got it perfect this time. It certainly doesn't mean they've got it right this time. But I think that it does show that there has been some progress in that.
And I think it's important, isn't it, to also recognise that. Because, yeah, as you say, that's the first time the WHO have ever done that. So that definitely has to be counted as progress. Put a pin in sexual and reproductive health, that this still matters, that it still needs to be priority and all the rest. So, yeah, I mean, that's really encouraging, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it did get the awareness raised, and I think it got different organisations and governments at least thinking about it. Not everyone took the same actions, but at least it was on the agenda to a much greater degree than it has been previously. And much earlier on, you know, quite often it's something which has come up later on during the epidemic, then everyone sort of thinks retrospectively that, you know, it might have been a good idea to be doing that earlier on, or have, you know, preparations in place even before the epidemic starts, because we know that epidemics are going to come and go. We know that emergencies are going to come and go. So, you know, in many fragile contexts, we will have in place plans which will include sexual reproductive health response, you know, strategically placed equipments for when we know that there's a high likelihood that there's going to be another shock to the system. I think where maybe we struggled a little bit more is actually in the high income settings that weren't as prepared and as ready for a big shock to their system as the countries that have, you know, gone through this, not necessarily through a pandemic, but have gone through other sort of humanitarian emergencies within the last decades or so.
Do you feel that the high income countries are prepared to turn to a middle income country to say, guys, what did you learn?
Oh, it's a really good question. I would love to say yes, but I don't feel that's, at least for myself, been my experience. I mean, this has been a really interesting year for everybody, and I can only really speak for myself. You know, over the last few years, I've had this really nice way of working where I've continued to work clinically both in the UK and then also in fragile states, and I've often seen, you know, the similarities and the differences between working in those two contexts, and also the benefits of it, that I always felt that there was a lot that I could take from my work in the UK to when I've gone to work in, say, a sub-Saharan African country, but also vice versa, that there's always been a lot that I've been able to take from my work overseas that I brought back to the UK, and the way that we approach different clinical problems or managing departments. Having this last year with COVID-19, where I've been again working very, very much in the London hospitals as the different waves have come and gone, but at the same time I've also been providing a lot of remote support to humanitarian settings being impacted by COVID-19. What I've noticed is that the similarities between the settings are massive, and there's sort of this false idea that we do it differently here compared to that, you know, because we all get affected by it in a very similar way, in the way that it has both the direct and indirect consequences, and particularly the way that the populations react, you know, the way that rumours spread through society, pulling down 5G masks, vaccine hesitancy, you know, a lot of things which, when I look back at Ebola epidemics, and, you know, we'd write about very similar episodes happening, and there was almost an arrogance from some of my UK colleagues, like, well, that would never really happen over here. And yet we're seeing it play out exactly like that over here. You know, I think that there's a huge opportunity that we could have taken, that our governments could have taken, to look back at what's happened in low middle income countries during previous epidemics, and also how they responded, particularly in the early phases to this pandemic, to try and get on top of it early. And I really didn't see that happening. And we, you know, we tried to, we published an article sort of relatively early on in this outbreak, trying to draw a lot of the lessons across from West African Ebola epidemic that would be relevant to this situation that we're facing in the UK. And also we submitted some of that as evidence to a review in the House of Lords, to sort of say, look, you know, there is a lot that we should be doing that we know happens in other countries. You know, it's something as simple as saying, you know, we know that in many low middle income countries that have had epidemics before, within days of knowing that this is getting going, they will have hand washing stations outside all public entrances. They'll have hand washing stations outside supermarkets, and they'll have people checking that that's happening. And, you know, I remember writing that, I think it was around April. And at that time, you know, that we still didn't have any sort of hand sanitizing or hand washing facilities widely available going in and out of shops and supermarkets. In fact, we didn't really have them going in and out of hospitals and healthcare facilities. You know, that came much later down the line. And I found that really surprising that we were so slow to get on top of these really basic public health messages and actions that should have been common sense to us. And I'm not sure why it was so slow. I'm not sure why we didn't get there. But I found it quite disheartening, if I'm honest.
I think they're definitely, when you put it like that, isn't it? And you hear it sort of, as you say, I think there has been opportunities that have been missed or things that could have been done more efficiently, more effectively. There'll be lessons learned from our point of view, isn't it, moving forward? But it does seem a bit of a shame. If that's being done reasonably easily in low middle income countries, why is it not happening with us? With regards to the research community and early career researchers and things like that, what role do you think they have to play in making sure maternal, newborn, sexual reproductive health topics aren't left off the agenda?
So I think, I mean, look, there's a disclaimer really is I'm not a researcher. So I can sort of give an opinion, but it's almost my lay opinion of what I think researchers should be doing. I think that researchers have a huge role in advocating, particularly, let's say, going back to sexual reproductive health during this pandemic. I think that there's a huge role that researchers can play in advocating on where we should be focusing our attention, both because a lot of researchers got experience with previous epidemics, with previous health emergencies, and should be able to really help guide our policymakers on where they should be focusing attention or you know, telling them in advance, you know, look, we know that these are going to be the pitfalls that are coming, and this is what we advise we should be looking at to avoid them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a good example of that would be, you know, looking now at, say, the vaccine that's being rolled out. If I look back at, again, you know, if I take Ebola, I, a couple of years ago, was advising on the use of the, at the time, experimental Ebola vaccine. It's not experimental anymore, but at the time it was an experimental Ebola vaccine, on whether or not we should be using it in pregnant women and breastfeeding women. And, you know, the ethics around that and the level of community engagement that would be needed for it, and weighing up the pros and cons and the risks to an individual of having that vaccine and the theoretical risks it might have to breastfeeding pregnancy versus the very real risks of contracting Ebola, right? Yeah. We're now at a place where we've had large-scale trials of COVID-19 vaccines. We're now rolling out COVID-19 vaccines. And you see the same conversations coming up around, should we be including pregnant and breastfeeding women? Should they have been included in the trials? Was there any sort of real grounded analysis on, is it right or wrong to include them? Or did we go back to that instinctive reflex that we often have, which is, let's just not include them because that's easier. And now we're in a place where we've got this big rollout of a vaccine. And everybody is, again, sitting on the fence. And I think it's only just today, actually, that it was reported that one of the vaccines will now be available to breastfeeding women. But that comes, if you think of it from a psychological perspective and a community engagement perspective, that comes after several weeks of a lot of social media conversation and general media conversation on pregnant women can't have this vaccine and breastfeeding women can't have this vaccine. And so, you know, in many ways, the damage is sort of done. And I think that potentially researchers could have had a much louder voice much earlier on in this conversation about where the vaccine should sit in access to pregnant women or women of reproductive age or breastfeeding women, so that we could then avoid this step now where we come to where I assume a lot of women who probably should get that vaccine and could quite safely have the vaccine, if you look at the theory behind vaccines and pregnancy and the precedents that we have of harm that they can cause, or in most cases that they don't cause harm, we could have avoided this situation that we're going to walk into now, because I think we're walking into it actually with our eyes wide open.
Yeah, I think that's a really fair point. And even just looking at my work WhatsApp group, and there's been that has been the chat for the last 24 hours, all these links and papers and stuff. And I think not only the pregnancy and breastfeeding, isn't it? There's so many women, well, might be in the early stages of pregnancy, you know, ladies who are thinking, oh, well, I might want to start a family, or we're kind of trying, so they rule themselves. You know, there's so, as you say, almost like that scaremongering or doubt that people get in their heads. It discounts so, so many people then. Add in some unhelpful media headlines and you're sort of onto a bit of a losing battle there, aren't you? So there's an opportunity there, isn't there, for the research community to, I guess, from the outset, stand up for people and say, you know what, we will include pregnant women, we will include breastfeeding mothers, because that's a huge part of our population and we need to look at that as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what's interesting, and it sort of goes back again to this sort of idea of lessons identified from previous, is that this isn't new. You know, this isn't the first time that we've had a new vaccine. And, you know, there's really well-established organizations within WHO. There's a, you know, strategic advisory group of experts specifically looking at the safety of vaccines in pregnancy and breastfeeding, which has existed long before the coronavirus pandemic. Yeah. And they've got, you know, really robust articles out there. In fact, some of them may have been shared in your WhatsApp group, which, you know, look at the safety profile of the different types of vaccines. You know, granted, you know, a couple of the vaccines that we have for COVID-19 are a new type of vaccine. But I think that, you know, the expertise were out there, that they could have had a louder voice.
And just thinking on a broader scale then about pandemics, or what disparities can arise to disadvantage women and children. And just wanted to know your thoughts on that, or any experiences that you might have had highlighting that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that, you know, you've sort of said more broadly, I'd say it certainly goes beyond pandemics. I think that any sort of crisis or emergency that creates a shift in not just in health, but in politics and economics of society, and the way that populations access healthcare or interact with one another, is going to have a disproportionate impact on women. Not just on women, but it's going to have a disproportionate impact on any, you know, groups within society that do not have the same levels of resilience or coping mechanisms that might be open to the more broader population. And so that the reason I put it like that is that it's going to vary from one country to another. It's going to vary from one context to another, the impact it has. And so although there'll probably be an impact in all countries, it's not going to be the same impact. I think that, you know, what we know from previous humanitarian emergencies and what we've seen as well during this pandemic is that, you know, if women don't feel that they're able to access healthcare, that the usual healthcare safely, or if it becomes unavailable, then there's going to be an increase in unintended pregnancies, potentially an increase in seeking abortions in unsafe ways, and all the harm that can cause. You can potentially see an increase in maternal morbidity and maternal death. And, you know, and we know that from other outbreaks and from other humanitarian emergencies. What we see go hand in hand with that is that the economic downturns may also end up driving an increase in unsafe sexual practices, such as, you know, the need for transactional sex, or teenage girls who would otherwise be in school being in places that they're not familiar with and having to make much more adult decisions than they normally would, and having an earlier sexual debut, and not necessarily having the access to contraception that they might have. So, you know, you see sort of how these things will start to play into one another. You know, if you have the use of the military in some countries to try and enforce lockdowns, we know that increasing militarization of society increases the likelihood of sexual violence, or again, transactional sex or survival sex, and the impact that can have. And so, you know, these things sort of snowball into one another.
Absolutely. It becomes a very tangled web, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And finally, what one lesson have you learnt from the work that you've been involved with this year would you take forward from COVID-19?
I think I've relearned a very positive lesson during this incredibly challenging year, challenging for everybody. For me, the lesson that I'm taking with me, we're talking on New Year's Eve, so, you know, the lesson that I'm taking with me for New Year's Eve tonight, the one thing that I think I can drink to, is that whatever work you're doing and however tough the times get, it really matters who you're working with. You know, if you're with a team that is able to support one another, that is able to pull together, that you can, you know, share your fears and concerns, but equally they can share theirs with you, and you can try to find a positive way forward, no matter what the situation around you is, then I, as cheesy as it sounds, I do think that anything is possible. And you know, for me, that's been the standout shining moment of this year, is when I've been working with incredible colleagues, incredible teams who have just really come together, gone above and beyond and supported one another during what has just been a very, very difficult time.
I think it's absolutely great. And I would definitely agree with you. It really is. It's been incredible to be surrounded by great people, and it makes a difference. It does make a difference on a personal level. And I think on a bigger scale with doing, you know, what we're all doing, being around good people. So that's definitely something that we will be taking into 2021 with us. Well, it's been really, really fascinating to hear your thoughts, your insights. Thank you so, so much for joining us on Sandy Sisters podcast. And we really wish you all the best for 2021.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, Tista, what did you think of what Benjamin shared?
What I really loved about this episode was getting to hear the perspectives and thoughts from a frontline health worker. And actually, on that note, a really huge, big thank you to all the frontline health workers out there for the incredible work they've been doing, especially during the pandemic. Drawing on his experiences during the Ebola crisis, I loved Benjamin's thoughts on how to ensure sustainability of SRH services post-pandemic. As Benjamin mentioned, when these catastrophic emergencies happen, having a joint approach with those leading in a pandemic response, working closely alongside existing health organisations in a symbiotic fashion, and not just as individual silos, is invaluable. Because ultimately, these emergencies are going to come and go. But what is important is that when the pandemic ends, health systems are strengthened enough to provide these services onwards, and also survive any further shocks that they may encounter. I also couldn't agree with Benjamin more on his thoughts about involving pregnant and breastfeeding women in research. I think this default mindset of excluding pregnant women out of studies without justification will stop us from finding effective and safe treatments that prevent poor maternal pregnancy and birth outcomes from occurring. And I think this is an issue of equity as much as anything else. There's a really fantastic paper and call to action on this topic published in December from The Lancet Global Health, and it's by Melanie Taylor and her colleagues. And during this review, they looked at 722 COVID-19 treatment studies as of July 2020, and 75% of them specifically excluded pregnant women. Now, if we exclude 75% of pregnant women from trials, how can we ensure that the care that we're giving mothers and babies are rooted in the strongest of evidence? I think this is really food for thought for us all going forward, in whatever research we do, that when we're in that initial stage of research design, we actively consider whether we can safely and effectively include pregnant women too.
I think you're so right in what you're saying. And I think there is something as early career researchers, isn't there, that we need to be thinking about and be mindful of as we plan projects, as our colleagues come up with research trials and we design those. And it can feel like a headache whenever we think, oh, ethics, whatever, you know. But actually, it's so crucial because we are excluding such a large community. I thought it was really important, the point that he raised about often in public health emergencies or epidemics, pandemics, etc., that we so often can get tunnel vision and forget the big picture. And if we think about our current situation, the world is captivated by COVID. Yeah. And of course, we need to be making every effort to address that, but not at the total expense of every other health concern. And I felt Ben just sharing that was just a really good reminder for me and for everyone, that we mustn't get blinkered, you know, like a horse, isn't it, with blinkers on, that they're just seeing one thing and we're forgetting everything else. And we all knew the phrase learning from our mistakes, but I think it would be fair to say on reflection from what Benjamin shared that perhaps we haven't been very good at doing that. And when I say we, I mean us as a country. And from his experience, it certainly sounds like there have been some improvements and lessons learned, but also plenty of missed opportunity to respond more quickly, or in a more effective way, perhaps, that we should have done. that exchange of knowledge between high-income and low-income countries was very insightful. And perhaps as a high-income country based in the UK, we could have been much more open to taking advice from our colleagues across the world who've had first-hand experience in epidemics and public health emergencies.
I think that's so true, and definitely something that came across so well from Ben's interview and chat with you, Amber. I think this whole pandemic has definitely been one big learning curve for people globally. And as we move towards vaccine rollout, fingers crossed, we're hoping to see some improvement. And I think this will be important for reflection and seeing how individual countries have implemented this strategy to control the virus, see what worked, see what didn't, and use this as lessons for any future shocks that we have globally. So if you've been listening, perhaps you've had some thoughts or comments about something that's been discussed this week, why not let us know on our Twitter at SANU Sisters or Instagram at SANU Sisters Podcast. We'd love to hear them.
And next week we have episode 9 coming out with Adura Bank-Thomas, a public health expert at London School of Economics who has an interest in health systems. He's going to be speaking to Tista and they'll be chatting all about how COVID has affected global maternal and newborn health financing. We can't wait for you to join us. Until then.